There was no name outside the bar because those who knew what it was didn't need one. Those who didn't know what it was shouldn't go in. Ankh Morpork's undead were, on the whole, a law-abiding bunch, if only because they knew the law paid them a certain amount of special attention. But if you walked into the place known as Beers on a dark night and had no business there, who would ever know? For the vampires, those, that is, who weren't gathered around the harmonium at the temperance mission, nervously singing songs about how much they liked cocoa, it was a place to hang up. For the werewolves, it was where you let your hair down. For the bogeymen, it was a place to come out of the closet. For the ghouls, it did a decent meat pasty and chips. All eyes, and that was not the same thing as the number of heads multiplied by two, turned to the door when it creaked open. The newcomers were surveyed from dark corners. They wore black, but that didn't mean anything. Anyone could wear black. They walked up to the bar and Mr. Pin rapped on the stained wood. The barman nodded. The important thing he'd found was to make sure ordinary people paid for their drinks as they bought them. It wasn't good business to let them run a tab. That showed an unwarranted optimism about the future. "What can I?" he began, before Mr. Tulip's hand caught him round the back of the neck and rammed his head down hard on the bar. "I am not having a nice day," said Mr. Pin, turning to the world in general, "and Mr. Tulip here suffers from unresolved personality conflicts. Has anyone got any questions?" An indistinct hand rose in the gloom.
"What, cook?"
said a voice. Mr. Pin opened his mouth to reply and then turned to his colleague, who was examining the bar's array of very strange drinks. All cocktails are sticky. The ones in Beers tended to be stickier.
"It says kill the cook,"
said the voice. Mr. Tulip rammed two long kebab skewers into the bar, where they vibrated.
"What cooks have you got?" he said.
"It's a good apron,"
said the voice in the gloom.
"It is the ing envy of all my friends," Mr. Tulip growled.
In the silence, Mr. Pin heard the unseen drinkers calculating the likely number of friends of Mr. Tulip. It was not a calculation that would involve a simple thinker taking off their shoes.
"All right,"
said someone. "Now, we don't want any trouble with you people," said Mr. Pin, "not as such. We simply wish to meet a werewolf." Another voice in the gloom said,
"Why?"
"Got a job for him," said Mr. Pin. There was some muffled laughter in the darkness, and a figure shuffled forward. It was about the size of Mr. Pin. It had pointy ears. It had a hairstyle that clearly continued to its ankles, inside its ragged clothes. Tufts of hair stuck out of holes in its shirt and densely thatched the backs of its hands.
"Part werewolf," it said.
"Which part?"
"That's a funny joke."
"Can you talk to dogs?" The self-confessed part werewolf looked around at its unseen audience, and for the first time Mr. Pin felt a twinge of disquiet. The sight of Mr. Tulip's slowly spinning eye and throbbing forehead were not having their usual effect. There were rustlings in the dark. He was sure he heard a snigger.
"Yep,"
said the werewolf. The hell with this, thought Mr. Pin. He pulled out his pistol bow in one practiced movement and held it an inch from the werewolf's face. "This is tipped with silver," he said. He was amazed at the speed of movement. Suddenly a hand was against his neck and five sharp points pressed into his skin.
"This ain't," said the werewolf. "Let's see who finishes squeezing first, eh?"
"Yeah, right,"
said Mr. Tulip, who was also holding something.
"That's just a barbecue fork,"
said the werewolf, giving it barely a glance.
"You want to see how ing fast I can throw it," said Mr. Tulip.
Mr. Pin tried to swallow, but only got halfway. Dead people, he knew, didn't squeeze that hard, but it was at least 10 steps to the door, and the space seemed to be getting wider by the heartbeat.
"Hey," he said, "there's no need for this, right? Why don't we all loosen up? And hey, it would help me to talk to you if you were your normal shape."
"No problem, my friend."
The werewolf winced and shuddered, but without at any point letting go of Mr. Pin's neck. The face contorted so much, features flowing together, that even Mr. Pin, who in other circumstances quite enjoyed that sort of thing, had to look away. This allowed him to see the shadow on the wall. It was, contrary to expectations, growing. So were its ears.
"Any questions?"
said the werewolf. Now its teeth seriously interfered with its speech. Its breath smelled even worse than Mr. Tulip's suit.
"Ah," said Mr. Pin, standing on tiptoe, "I think we've come to the wrong place."
"I think that also."
At the bar, Mr. Tulip bit the top off a bottle in a meaningful way. Once again the room was filled with the ferocious silence of calculation and the personal mathematics of profit and loss. Mr. Tulip smashed a bottle against his forehead. At this point he did not appear to be paying much attention to the room. He just happened to have a bottle in his hand, which he did not need any more. Putting it on the bar would have required an unnecessary expenditure of hand-eye coordination. People recalculated.
"Is he human?" said the werewolf.
"Well, of course, human is just a word," said Mr. Pin. He felt weight slowly press down onto his toes as he was lowered to the floor. "I think perhaps we'll just be going," he said carefully.
"Right,"
said the werewolf. Mr. Tulip had smashed open a big jar of pickles, or at least things that were long, chubby and green, and was trying to insert one up his nose. "If we wanted to stay, we would," said Mr. Pin.
"Right, but you want to go. So does your friend," said the werewolf.
Mr. Pin backed towards the door. "Mr. Tulip, we have business elsewhere," he said.
"She's take the damn pickle out of your nose, will you? We're supposed to be professionals."
"That's not a pickle," said a voice in the dark.
Mr. Pin was uncharacteristically thankful when the door slammed behind them. To his surprise, he also heard the bolts shoot home.
"Well, that could have gone better," he said, brushing dust and hair off his coat.
"What now?"
said Mr. Tulip.
"Time to think of a plan B," said Mr. Pin.
"Why don't we just ing it people until someone tells us where the dog is?"
said Mr. Tulip.
"Tempting," said Mr. Pin, "but we'll leave that for plan C."
"Bugger it!"
They both turned.
"Bent treacle edges, I told them," said foul old Ron,
lurching across the street, a wad of Timeses under one arm and the string of his nondescript mongrel in his other hand. He caught sight of the new firm.
"Hoggle Garley Europe," he said. "They are Benip. You gents want a paper?"
It seemed to Mr. Pin that the last sentence, while in pretty much the same voice, had an intrusive, not quite right quality. Apart from anything else, it made sense.
"You got some change?" he said to Mr. Tulip, patting his pockets.
"You're gonna ing buy one?" said his partner.
"There's a time and a place, Mr. Tulip, a time and a place. Here you are, mister."
"Millennium, hand and shrimp, bagger it," said Ron, adding, "Much obliged, gents."
Mr. Pin opened the Times.
"This thing has got..."
He stopped and looked closer.
"Have you seen this dog?" he said.
"Shit!"
He stared at Ron.
"You sell lots of these things," he said.
"Quadle of slops, I told him."
"Yeah, hundreds."
There it was again, the slight sensation of two voices.
"Hundreds," said Mr. Pin.
He looked down at the paper seller's dog. It looked pretty much like the one in the paper, but all terriers looked alike. Anyway, this one was on a string.
"Hundreds," he said again, and read the short article again.
He stared.
"I think we have a plan B," he said.
At ground level, the newspaper seller's dog watched them carefully as they walked away.
"That was too close to comfort," it said,
when they turned the corner. Foul old Ron put down his papers in a puddle and pulled a cold sausage from the depths of his hulking coat. He broke it into three equal pieces. The Ankh-Morpork Times. "The truth shall make ye Fred." Extra. "Have you seen this dog? $25 reward for information." William had dithered over that, but the watch had supplied quite a good drawing, and he felt right now that a little friendly gesture in that direction would be a good idea. If he found himself in deep trouble head downwards, he'd need someone to pull him out. He had rewritten the patrician story too, adding as much as he was certain of, and there wasn't much of that. He was, frankly, stuck. Saccharissa had penned a story about the opening of the Enquirer. William had hesitated about this too, but it was news after all. They couldn't just ignore it, and it filled them space. Besides, he liked the opening line, which began, "A would-be rival to Ankh-Morpork's old established newspaper, The Times, has opened in Gleam Street." "You're getting good at this," he said, looking across the desk.
"Yes," she said. "Now I know that if I see a naked man, I should definitely get his name and address, because..."
William joined in the chorus. "Names sell papers." He sat back and drank the really horrible tea the dwarfs made. Just for a moment there was an unusual feeling of bliss. Strange word, he thought. It's one of those words that describes something that does not make a noise, but if it did make a noise, would sound just like that. Bliss. It's like the sound of a soft meringue melting gently on a warm plate. Here and now he was free. The paper was put to bed, tucked up, had its prayers listened to. It was finished. The crew were already filing back in for more copies, cursing and spitting. They'd commandeered a variety of old trolleys and prams to cart their papers out into the streets. Of course, in an hour or so, the mouth of the press would be hungry again, and he'd be back pushing the huge rock uphill, just like that character in mythology. What was his name? "Who was that hero who was condemned to push a rock up a hill, and every time he got it to the top, it rolled down again?" he said. Saccharissa didn't look up. "Someone who needed a wheelbarrow," she said, spiking a piece of paper with some force. William recognised the voice of someone who still has an annoying job to do. "What are you working on?" he said. "A report from the Ankh-Morpork Recovering Accordion Players Society," she said, scribbling fast. "Is there something wrong with it?" "Yes, the punctuation. There isn't any. I think we might have to order an extra box of commas." "Why are you bothering with it, then?" 26 people are mentioned by name." "As accordionists?" "Yes." "Won't they complain?" "They didn't have to play the accordion." "Oh, and there was a big crash on Broadway. A cart overturned and several tons of flour fell onto the road, causing a couple of horses to rear and upset their cartload of fresh eggs, and that caused another cart to shed 30 churns of milk. So, what do you think of this as a headline?" She held up a piece of paper on which she'd written, "City's Biggest Cake Mix-Up." William looked at it. Yes, somehow it had everything. The sad attempt at humour was exactly right. It was just the sort of thing that would cause much mirth around Mrs. Arcanum's table. "Lose the second exclamation mark," he said. "Otherwise, I think it's perfect. How did you hear about it?" "Oh, Constable Fiddiment dropped in and told me," said Saccharissa. She looked down and shuffled papers unnecessarily. "I think he's a bit sweet on me, to tell you the truth." A tiny, hitherto unregarded bit of William's ego instantly froze solid. An awful lot of young men seemed happy to tell Saccharissa things. He heard himself say, "Vimes doesn't want any of his officers to speak to us." "Yes, well, I don't think telling me about a lot of smashed eggs counts, does it?" "Yes, but... anyway, I can't help it if young men want to tell me things, can I?" "I suppose not, but..." "Anyway, that's it for tonight." Saccharissa yawned. "I'm going home." William got up so quickly he skinned his knees on the desk. "I'll walk you there," he said. "Good grief, it's nearly 8:15, said Saccharissa, putting on her coat. "Why do we keep on working?" "Because the press doesn't go to sleep," said William. As they stepped out into the silent street, he wondered if Lord Vetinari had been right about the press. There was something compelling about it. It was like a dog that stared at you until you fed it. A slightly dangerous dog. Dog bites man, he thought. But that's not news. That's olds. Saccharissa let him walk her to the end of the street, where she made him stop. "It'll embarrass Grandfather if you're seen with me," she said. "I know it's stupid, but neighbours, you know. And all this guild stuff." "I know. The air hung heavy for a moment as they looked at each other. "I don't know how to put this," said William, knowing that sooner or later it had to be said. "But I ought to say that, though you are a very attractive girl, you're not my type." She gave him the oldest look he'd ever seen, and then said, "That took a lot of saying, and I would like to thank you. I just thought that with me and you working together all the time..." "No, I'm glad one of us said it," she said. "And with smooth talk like that, I bet you have the girls just lining up, right? See you tomorrow." He watched her walk down the street to her house. After a few seconds, a lamp went on in an upper window. By running very fast, he arrived back at his lodgings just late enough for a look from Mrs. Arcanum, but not so late as to be barred from the table for impoliteness. Serious latecomers had to eat their supper at the table in the kitchen. It was curry tonight. And one of the strange things about eating at Mrs. Arcanum's was that you got more leftovers than you got original meals. That is, there were far more meals made up from what were traditionally considered the prudently usable remains of earlier meals, stews, bubble and squeak, curry, than there were meals at which those remains could have originated. The curry was particularly strange, since Mrs. Arcanum considered foreign parts only marginally less unspeakable than private parts, and therefore added the curious yellow curry powder with a very small spoon, lest everyone should suddenly tear their clothes off and do foreign things. The main ingredients appeared to be swede and gritty rainwater-tasting sultanas and the remains of some cold mutton, although William couldn't remember when they'd had the original mutton at any temperature. This was not a problem for the other lodgers. Mrs. Arcanum provided big helpings, and they were men who measured culinary achievements by the amount you got on your plate. It might not taste astonishing, but you went to bed full, and that was what mattered. At the moment, the news of the day was being discussed. Mr. McElduff had bought the Inquirer and both editions of the Times in his role as keeper of the fire of communication. It was generally agreed that the news in the Inquirer was more interesting, although Mrs. Arcanum ruled that the whole subject of snakes was not one for the dinner table, and papers ought not to be allowed to disturb people like this. Rains of insects and so on, though, fully confirmed everyone's view of distant lands. Olds, thought William, forensically dissecting a sultana. His lordship was right. Not news, but olds. Telling people what they think they already know is true. The patrician, it was agreed, was a shifty one. The meeting concurred that they were all alike, the lot of them. Mr. Windling said the city was in a mess, and there ought to be some changes. Mr. Longshaft said that he couldn't speak for the city, but from what he had heard, the gemstone business had been very brisk of late. Mr. Windling said that it was all right for some. Mr. Prone put forth the opinion that the watch could not find their bottom with both hands, a turn of phrase that almost earned him a place at the kitchen table to finish his meal. It was agreed that Vetinari had done it all right, and should be put away. The main course adjourned at 8:45 p.m., and was followed by disintegrating plums in runny custard, Mr. Prone getting slightly fewer plums as an unspoken reprimand. William went up to his room early. He had adapted to Mrs. Arcanum's cuisine, but nothing except radical surgery would make him like her coffee. He lay down on the narrow bed in the dark. Mrs. Arcanum supplied one candle weekly, and what with one thing and another, he'd forgotten to buy any extra, and tried to think. Mr. Slant walked across the floor of the empty ballroom, his feet echoing on the wood. He took his position in the circle of candlelight with a slight twanging of nerves. As a zombie, he was always a little edgy about fire. He coughed.
"Well," said a chair.
"They didn't get the dog," said Mr. Slant. "In all other respects, I have to say they did a masterly job."
"How bad could it be if the watch found it?"
"As I understand it, the dog in question is quite old," said Mr. Slant into the candlelight. "I have instructed Mr. Pin to look for it, but I don't believe he will find it easy to get access to the city's canine underground."
"There are other werewolves here, aren't there?"
"Yes," said Mr. Slant smoothly, "but they won't help. There are very few of them, and Sergeant Angua of the Watch is very important in the werewolf community. They won't help strangers, because she will find out."
"And bring the watch down on them?"
"I believe she would not bother with the watch," said Slant.
"The dog is probably in some dwarf stewpot by now," said a chair. There was general laughter.
"If things go wrong," said a chair, "who do these men know?"
"They know me," said Mr. Slant. "I would not worry unduly. Vimes works by the rules."
"I've always understood him to be a violent and vicious man," said a chair.
"Quite so. And because this is what he knows himself to be, he always works by the rules. In any case, the guilds will be meeting tomorrow."
"Who will be the new patrician?" said a chair.
"That will be a matter for careful discussion and a consideration of all shades of opinion," said Mr. Slant. His voice could have oiled watches.
"Mr. Slant," said a chair.
"Yes?"
"Do not try that on us. It is going to be Scrope, isn't it?"
"Mr. Scrope is certainly well thought of by many of the leading figures in the city," said the lawyer.
"Good."
And the musty air was loud with unspoken conversation. Absolutely no one needed to say, "A lot of the most powerful men in the city owe their positions to Lord Vetinari." And nobody replied, "Certainly, but to the kind of men who seek power, gratitude has very poor keeping qualities. The kind of men who seek power tend to deal with matters as they are. They would never try to depose Vetinari, but if he was gone, then they would be practical." No one said, "Will anyone speak up for Vetinari?" Silence replied, "Oh, everyone. They'll say things like, 'Poor fellow, it was the strain of office, you know.' They'll say, 'It's the quiet ones that crack.' They'll say, 'Quite so. We should put him somewhere where he can do no harm to himself or others, don't you think?' They'll say, 'Perhaps a small statue would be in order, too.' They'll say, 'The least we can do is call off the watch. We owe him that much.' They'll say, 'We must look to the future.' And so, quietly, things change. No fuss, and very little mess." No one said, "Character assassination, what a wonderful idea. Ordinary assassination only works once, but this one works every day." A chair did say,
I wondered whether Lord Downey or even Mr. Boggis.
Another chair said, Oh, come now, why should they? Much better this way.
True, true. Mr. Scrope is a man of fine qualities.
A good family man, I understand.
Listens to the common people.
Not just to the common people, I trust.
Oh, no, he's very open to advice from informed focus groups.
He'll need plenty of that.
No one said he's a useful idiot.
Nevertheless, the watch will have to be brought to heel.
Vimes will do what he is told. He must do. Scrope will be at least as legitimate a choice as Vetinari was. Vimes is the kind of man who must have a boss because that gives him legitimacy.
Slant coughed.
Is that all, gentlemen? He said.
What about the Ankh-Morpork Times? Said a chair. Bit of a problem shaping up there.
People find it amusing, said Mr. Slant, and nobody takes it seriously. The Enquirer outsells it 2-1 already, after just one day, and it is underfinanced, and it has a difficulty with supplies.
Good tale in the Enquirer about that woman and the snake, said a chair.
Was there? Said Mr. Slant.
The chair that had first mentioned the Times had something on its mind.
I'd feel happier if a few likely lads smashed up the press, it said.
That would attract attention, said a chair. The Times wants attention. The writer craves to be noticed.
Oh, well, if you insist.
I would not dream of insisting, but the Times will collapse, said the chair.
And this was the chair that the other chairs listened to.
The young man is also an idealist. He has yet to find out what's in the public interest, is not what the public is interested in.
Say again?
I mean, gentlemen, that people probably think he's doing a good job, but what they are buying is the Enquirer. The news is more interesting. Did I ever tell you, Mr. Slant, that a lie will go round the world before the truth has got its boots on?
A great many times, sir, said Slant, with slightly less than his usual keen diplomacy.
He realized this and added,
A valuable insight, I'm sure.
Good.
The most important chair sniffed.
Keep an eye on our workman, Mr. Slant.
It was midnight in the Temple of Om in the Street of Small Gods, and one light burned in the vestry. It was a candle in a very heavy, ornate candlestick, and it was, in a way, sending a prayer to heaven. The prayer, from the Gospel according to the Miscreants, was, Don't let anyone find us pinching this stuff. Mr. Pin rummaged in a cupboard.
I can't find anything in your size, he said. It looks as though... Oh, no, sheesh. Incense is for burning.
Tulip sneezed, pebble dashing the opposite wall with sandalwood.
You could have told me before, he muttered. I've got some papers.
Have you been chasing the oven cleaner again? Said Mr. Pin accusingly. I want you focused, understand? Now, the only thing I can find in here that will fit you...
The door creaked open, and a small, elderly priest wandered into the room. Mr. Pin instinctively grasped the big candlestick.
"Hello, are you here for the midnight service?"
said the old man, blinking in the light. This time it was Tulip who grabbed Mr. Pin's arm as he raised the candlestick.
"Are you mad? What kind of person are you?"
he growled.
"What? We can't let him—"
Mr. Tulip snatched the silver stick out of his partner's hand.
"I mean, look at that ing thing, will you?"
he said, ignoring the bemused priest.
"That's a genuine Cellini, 500 years old. Look at the chasing work on that snuffer, will you? Sheesh, to you, it's nothing more than 5 pounds of silver, right?
Actually, it's a futtock, said the old priest, who still hadn't yet got up to mental speed.
What, the pupil?
Said Mr. Tulip, his eyes ceasing their spin out of surprise. He turned the candlestick over and looked at the base.
Hey, that's right. There's a Cellini mark, but it's stamped with a little F, too. First time I've ever seen his ing early stuff. He was a better ing silversmith, too. It's just a shame he had such a stupid name. Do you know how much that'd sell for, Reverend?
We thought about $70, said the priest, looking hopeful. It was in a lot of furniture that an old lady left the church. Really, we kept it for sentimental value.
Have you still got the box it came in?
Said Mr. Tulip, turning the candlestick over and over in his hands.
He did wonderful ing presentation boxes, cherry wood.
No, I don't think so.
Ing shame.
Is it still worth anything? I think we've got another one somewhere.
To the right collector, maybe 4,000 ing dollars, said Mr. Tulip. But I reckon you could get 12,000 if you'd got the ing pair. Futtock is very collectible at the moment.
12,000, burbled the old man. His eyes gleamed with a deadly sin.
Could be more, Mr. Tulip nodded. It's a ing delightful piece. I feel quite privileged to have seen it.
He looked sourly at Mr. Pin.
And you are going to use it as a ing blunt instrument.
He put the candlestick reverentially on the vestry table and buffed it carefully with his sleeve. Then he spun round and brought his fist down hard on the head of the priest, who folded up with a sigh.
And they were just keeping it in a ing cupboard, he said. Honestly, I could ing spit.
Do you want to take it with us? Said Mr. Pin, stuffing clothes into a bag.
Nah, all the fences round here probably just melted down for the silver, said Mr. Tulip. I couldn't have something like that on my ing conscience. Let's find this ing dog and get right out of this dump, shall we? It makes me so ing despondent.